He's a sneaky thief, and I'm a heavy armor, dual-wielding axe murderer. And I don't like clicking something to death. I would much rather pull a trigger. Let's psychoanalyze that, shall we?
Oh, man. You've said a lot today that kind of, yeah. I've taken notes. Welcome to Psych Tech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast. As always, my name is Josue Cardona, and with me is Kelly Dunlap. What's up, Kelly?
Not much. How's it going?
All right. We're back to video games again. I didn't think it would be this soon.
Well, I thought it probably would be. You can't keep us away for long.
Oh, and this is important because I use what we're going to talk about all the time. For the past few years, the Entertainment Software Association's data has been something that is my go-to for a lot of things, and I include it in a lot of presentations. Do you use it the same way? Is it something that you go to, or do you not pay attention to it much?
Oh, yeah. It is. It's in my dissertation. I just presented at the Maryland Psychological Association earlier this week, and the 2015 ESA came out the night before. So I swapped out my slides and updated the info and presented it there as well. So this is kind of a foundational bedrock piece of data for people like us.
Yeah, and it's the Entertainment Software Association's Essential Facts of 2015. And they do this report every year. And for those of you who don't know what the ESA is, let me read you a little bit about the association. From the actual report, it says, the ESA conducts business and consumer research and provides analysis and advocacy on issues like global content protection, intellectual property, technology, e-commerce, and the First Amendment in support of interactive software publishers. ESA owns and operates E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, and represents video game industry interests on federal and state levels. So they're on our team.
Yes.
So what is your, like, what were your biggest takeaways, or where do you want to start? Because there's a few things I want to pick at that are very specific. I've got page numbers. I've got things highlighted, yeah.
Do you have, like, subsection 6, line 2, subparagraph 8?
Thankfully, it's, actually, that'll be probably easier, because it's all, every page is just like an infographic.
It is, and that's why pretty. I love it. Yeah. it's very visual, which I think, when you're talking about statistics, if you can make them visual and pretty, that does so much for you and for making people care about what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
I mean, I guess one of the best places for me to start and what I usually do in my presentations is I use this as kind of my intro. I quiz whoever I'm talking with about what they know about quote-unquote gamers.
Or what they think.
Yeah, what they think they know. Yeah. So my favorite, it's usually my opening question is, what is the average age of somebody who plays video games? And I'll give like 12, 18, 27, 34, and 40. And I don't think anybody's ever gotten it right.
And 40 is the closest one, probably, usually.
Well, according to the 2015, 35. The average game player is now 35.
Let me see. Wait, I'm looking at the... Yes. And the average purchaser is 37.
Yes.
Okay, so that's person, what I was looking at. Yeah,
person buying the game, which is really interesting because I think it was 2014, maybe the 2013 ESA, because this comes out every year, that the average age dropped to 31 and now it's bounced back up to 35, which to me is really interesting because I thought it was starting to trend younger, but the older gamers are picking up the slack.
Well, I think that the gamers are just getting older too, you know? I mean, it's I've always felt like I do a lot more of video game playing now that I'm an adult and I have money than when I was a kid. That's always been pretty obvious to me. At least that's my life story. So yeah, it's funny because that number keeps trending upwards and I was right there at the age, and yeah, now it's moving up a little more, right? It's like mm-hmm. bumped up a little, but yeah, it's, we're getting older, right? So it's interesting. Yeah. But games are more accessible. So I guess everybody in every age group is getting in on the action because now there's just more and more people who are playing.
Well, yeah, the idea is that if it was trending younger, that would mean that everybody who is 30 or older, there's no growth in that area, but obviously there's more kids coming into the world every single day, and they continue to play. I think the stat is 97% of all children under 18 play video games. Maybe not like every day, but they play them, and they consider them part of their lives. And so by the fact that it's continuing to stay in the mid-30s and or even go up, it means that people over that age are continuing to grow as gamers at a faster rate than people under that age.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is amazing. So it's not just us Atari kids and Sega Master System kids who are staying here, that the population is actually growing, even though there's no quote-unquote gamers being born into it because we're all in our 30s or older.
Yeah, yeah. And the chart says 155 million Americans play video games. That's the first stat in the report.
That's roughly half, and that number grows every single year.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that I always drive home when I give my presentations to mental health providers, social workers, anybody like that, that over half the country plays video games. And we're at this point where we can't ignore them. Video games used to be a very small, subsect, kind of underground, counterculture type of thing that was a hobby. But now it is so predominant to not be culturally competent in video games is the same as trying to treat somebody from, let's say, a Japanese culture or a Chinese culture without any kind of understanding of what those cultures mean.
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt like I'm in battle, right? Whenever I give a presentation or whenever I'm talking about what I'm doing, I'm trying to defend gaming and trying to defend gamers. But this report more than ever makes me feel like maybe it's not that much of an uphill battle anymore. Maybe we're kind of like at the top of that hill, and now it should be smoother sailing from now on.
Have you noticed, either in practice or in presentations, that people tend to be more receptive to the idea now compared to maybe a couple years ago when they put the brakes on a little bit harder?
I mean, I still see a lot of news articles, a lot of news reports that start off, well, you know, we all think that video games are bad for you, but actually, and there's still that bias in the reporting,
mm-hmm.
but the bias is presented kind of as a legacy comment, you know, like this is what we've been saying for years, but then what follows up is actually a positive report. And I don't hear as many negative reports as we used to. Actually, the most negative parts are the intros to the positive reports, which is really interesting. And just in working with people, I have found this shift. You know, women in their 40s who tell me, oh, yeah, to unwind, you know, I'll play a little Candy Crush or I'll play this game. You know, a lot of, thanks to mobile gaming, there are tons of games I've never heard of. And clones of other games and things like that. And a lot of people it's more normal, you know, for people at different age groups to play, thanks to the accessibility, mm-hmm. right, of mobile devices. Although I want to talk about that stat in a second. I thought mobile would be a lot bigger percentage of the games that are being played. But yeah, I think I have seen a shift. And I think I've always got into it expecting a fight, and now it's a little easier.
Yeah, I definitely have that same experience where it used to be a lot more hush hush, don't talk about it. And as I've continued to speak, it's people are approaching it more open minded. And I've found that when I kind of present on it as a culture, you know, just as you would any other culture, that it's you just need to be aware of it. You don't have to use it in therapy or as therapy, but you do have to be aware of it. That tends to get some pretty good response. There's always one, when I was presenting at the RICA, which is a youth inpatient treatment center here, I presented there last month. There was one guy who was probably in his 80s who was a bit stodgy in his and cold in his reception of my presentation, but everybody else was super interested and curious. And I think that's the most important thing for clinicians out there is to keep that curiosity about what this thing is. It is not this evil thing. It is just a tool, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, and it's a part of people's lives is the most important thing.
Right? Yeah. I mean, there's even a quote that millennials are putting video games at the center of their entertainment preferences. First of all, I hate the term millennials. And that's a whole different rant. But the idea that, yes, video games are now a centerpiece of the majority of Americans' lives, whether they're on the train, whether they're playing mobile, whether they're on their console or their PC or their tablet. And it's only going to continue to grow. And I think the platform's going to change. I mean, you mentioned, Hostway, that you thought that social would be bigger, right?
Mobile is what
I thought. Mobile, sorry.
Yeah, because social is huge, yeah, in the stats, but mobile.
Yeah. And I think, I guess going back to your original question about what stat was the most impressive to me or the most exciting was the one under parental controls, where 91% of parents reported controlling what their kids play. And I think that number is absolutely staggering.
See, let me see. Is it 94% of parents always or sometimes pay attention to the video games their child plays? That one's on the same page. And I put a big question mark next to it because I kind of don't believe it.
It is. It's kind of one of those that, okay, I'm being asked, do I pay attention to what my child plays? You know, I better say yes, because otherwise I'm a bad parent, even though I don't. But, I mean, it does say sometimes, and I'm going to guess that that has a lot to do with it, because sometimes is very vague.
I don't know, but I've always wanted to do these kind of workshops or classes where I talk about the latest video games and kind of what they touch upon, and both the good and the bad, because I think, you know, a lot of people think that some games don't have any redeeming qualities and that other games don't have any negative qualities. You know, and do you really want your kids doing some of the things that you can do in some of these video games? And I don't think that people are really aware of what you can do in a lot of games. So I don't know. That is the one thing that really stood out to me from the whole report. And I thought, if that's true, that's amazing. Like, that's it. That's it. We won. But right. But I just don't believe it.
It's hard to believe. It really is, especially. But I also wonder if that's because we have this very skewed representation. Because the people we tend to work with are the ones who are not doing it. We tend to only see people who are having problems as opposed to people who aren't having problems. So I often have to remind myself that the sample that I'm used to seeing is a very, very small slice of what is actually going on.
Yeah, and I, my scope isn't as, like, my scope of work is not as limited anymore. I do branch out a bit. And I still see the same thing. I still see kids playing games that, you know, an adult maybe bought for them, or they bought themselves online, you know, because you don't have that kind of checks that you have at a GameStop, and they're talking about things that they're doing, or they're even watching videos online. It doesn't matter if the parents are letting them play or not. And I don't know, it's still surprising, unless there's actually, like, parents are aware and they just don't care, which is very possible.
That is very possible.
Yeah, maybe we're not as sensitive to so many things as we were before. It's like, oh, yeah, they're shooting up cops. Whatever. It's okay. You know, and okay. All right. As long as if they're aware and they're okay with it, then that stat is accurate. Right. But that has to be it, I'm guessing. I don't know. I still have a hard time with that stat.
Yeah, anytime you get numbers that big, you know, 90% or anything really over 75%, I do tend to become a little bit more skeptical, just because in social science, getting anything to jive like that is, it should make you question some things. But I think it's a little bit of kind of what everything that you just said, you know, parents who actually pay attention and know what their kids are doing. Parents who pay attention but don't know what their kids are doing. Like, oh yeah, I make sure that Jimmy only plays 3 hours a week. I don't know what Jimmy is playing, but I make sure it's only 3 hours a week. There's parents who probably don't pay attention and don't care. There's parents who care, but they just don't know what to do. Oh, Grand Theft Auto, is that a good thing? Is that like Minecraft? You know, well, I'll buy it for Timmy because, and I don't know. But I think it's also important to remember that the amount of people who are gamers are 35, are people who have come up on games themselves, and they don't have to do a lot of research on what game is appropriate for their children, because gamers are now having gamer babies. And as opposed to my parents, who had no idea what Sonic was, they had to learn about video games through their children. Parents now are picking the games that their children play. There was this really great article about a dad who had, I don't remember if it was his son or his daughter, but basically when the kid was little, dad brought out the old school Nintendo, or maybe even the Atari, and that's what the kids started playing on. And then I think every year, every 2 years, Dad brought out the next gen console. So if they started on Atari, then the next one was the NES, and then it was the Super NES, and then it was the PlayStation. And so this child grew up in the same kind of arc that his father had, and has a huge appreciation for games and the content and things like that. So I think maybe parents are more savvy. Parents are definitely more savvy. That's what I'm going to go with. I'm going to take the optimistic spin.
I don't know. Again, I have no research, just anecdotal data, but I don't know.
I really wish that the ESA provided how many people were polled and how they find the people to take the survey. Mm-hmm. I feel like that is really important methodological data that we don't have. And I mean, it's also always important to consider the source. This is the ESA. This is a company that has a vested interest in making video games and computer games seem good. I mean, that is important to them. So, you know, grain of salt, always question, always be curious. But yeah, there is, I mean, like the stat here, gamers who own dedicated game consoles use them for entertainment media in addition to playing games. And the biggest one, 54%, is using their consoles to watch movies, and even 33% watch TV shows. And to me, this absolutely blows my mind, because when the Xbox One was announced 2 years ago, there was this enormous shitstorm. I guess I can say that. There's this enormous shitstorm of people raging that they don't want a box that will play Netflix. They want to play games, and how dare you? And you know that you're catering to the casual, not the hardcore gamer. But then you go, and those people now, they're all up in Netflix. So,
well, to be fair, the 360 was huge for Netflix. And so was the PS3. But it was Microsoft's focus on putting that first and foremost.
Like, yeah, they were the marketing strategy was great.
Yeah, they said, no, we are an entertainment center first, and it plays video games, right? That was their way of spinning it. And yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think there was ever any intention, even after the backlash, to remove any of that. And it's still pretty much front and center. I mean, you can do things that are very entertainment focused. You can put your cable box through the machine. But yeah, I don't know. That's a whole other discussion.
I mean, it is. It's the idea that I'm going to guess that this is the last console. I think
absolutely
the Xbox
not.
One is going
absolutely
to be.
Not.
I think it's the last console, because I think what comes next is a fully integrated entertainment system. I mean, the Xbox One is almost that already, but I think the next thing to come out is going just to be, especially if it has a life cycle as long as the 360 did. You know, 7-8 years is a long time. And I think the next thing that is going to be put out by Microsoft, it's going to have gaming, and it's going to have, I mean, look at Sling and look at HBO Go and all these other services that are coming out of the woodwork to work with these gaming companies to circumvent traditional, you know, cable companies or telecom companies. I don't think we're going to see a freestanding gaming console from Microsoft, at least, the next time around. I think it's just going to be part of something larger.
Well, we're already there. Even a Nintendo DS has Netflix. You know?
But it's still branded as a gaming.
Sure, but my iPhone is branded as a phone, and that's the least thing I do with it.
I know, me too.
You know, so I mean, so I think we're already there. Everybody wants to be able to do everything on everything, right? We want our toaster and our refrigerator to also have Netflix built in, or at least Pandora. You know, please at least give me some music streaming. You know, so, but yeah, yeah. But how did we get to this point? Which stat were we on?
I was looking at the amount of time people spend doing other things than gaming on their consoles.
Gotcha.
So watching movies or TV shows or music, watching live streams. And that's another thing that is absolutely huge, is watching people live stream. So through Twitch or other mediums, people are spending a ton of time doing that. But to my knowledge, nobody's really capturing that. I think Twitch has some stats about it. YouTube probably has stats about it. But that's not being incorporated into this ESA piece, and I think it needs to be.
Yeah.
Because when you talk to gamers or people who play games, how do you answer the question, you know, how much time do you spend playing video games per week? Well, is that me physically playing? Or what if I'm watching a Twitch stream of somebody else playing? Does that still count? I'm still involved in the culture, but I'm not actively... It's this huge nebulous mess that I can't wait to dig into.
Yeah, yeah. If a parent walks by and they see a game running on the TV, do they assume that you're playing? Do they even know the difference? Do you watch? Do you like to watch Twitch streams or any kind of live stream gaming?
I do, but I also do a lot of streaming myself.
Okay.
So through my gaming site, we stream about 4 hours every week, which is not a whole lot, but it's... And this weekend, we did a 24-hour stream to raise money for a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
So I streamed a lot this weekend. But I've got a friend of mine. His name is Proteus Joker, and he is a world record holder in speedrunning for Halo. So how awesome is that? If you're not familiar, speedrunning is being able to get through a game as fast as you physically can. And he got through all four Halos, so Halo 1, 2, 3, and 4, not Reach, all the ones on the Master Chief Collection, in 8 hours, which is insane. Absolutely insane.
What difficulty?
I think he was on Heroic. I'm not entirely sure, but I mean, even on Easy, I can't even get through a game that fast. But so it's a lot of fun to watch. And then if anybody follows the HCS, the Halo Championship Series, they were streaming. IG Atlanta was last weekend. So all the big pros come together in these places, and they have these huge tournaments which are streamed, and it's a ton of fun to watch. It is definitely more fun when you're with an audience, but it can still be really, really cool at home too, especially because Twitter tends to integrate it, and you'll see people going, oh my gosh, sick headshot on Twitter, and you're seeing it on your screen, and it can be a very community-oriented experience. So yes, to answer your question, yes, I do. How about you?
Not really. Just it's the same way, like if I'm watching sports or I'm watching someone else doing something, I get kind of bored. Like, I want to do it myself. I do like speed runs and things like that. I have seen some crazy speed runs, like people doing stuff blindfolded or with one hand, and and just crazy glitches and stuff like that is fun. But I don't really enjoy watching live streams. And I know that games like Dota and League of Legends, they have huge viewerships, and they're getting crazy numbers on their streams and when they do competitions. And so, it's our football, baseball, basketball, right? It's getting to that point. And yeah, it's surprising to me how many people, like, I understand, I don't know, I guess it's the same mentality, like, okay, I can't play as good as Michael Jordan, but I can watch Michael Jordan play. It's kind of the same way with the games, but I still rather go out and do it or do something. So I don't watch a lot of Twitch streaming. Sometimes a friend of mine will have a Twitch stream up and I'll watch for a few minutes, but I don't really enjoy it. But I know that it's happening a lot. And my PS4 has it integrated from day one. There's a share button. You just hit one button and you start streaming. Mm-hmm. And, it's built into the console. That's how popular it is.
Yep, it's the same thing on the Xbox. You just say Xbox broadcast, and it automatically loads everything up, starts streaming you to Twitch, and it's really cool. As someone in that community, I really enjoy it. I think it's a lot of fun, and especially when you know the people who are either doing the run or the game, or the people in the chat box who are supporting them. Like, entire communities are springing up around individual people, and it's really cool. I mean, of course, there's the dark side, because there's always a dark side. But for the most part, it's a very interesting, inclusive experience.
Yeah, and I mean, it is the biggest, like, whenever I try to compare video games to sports in the past, like, this is the biggest analog, right? I think this is the biggest similarity now for, like, the consumer side, not so much from the athletes. Because we're spending tons of time playing, but there are other people who are spending sometimes even more time actually watching. It is interesting. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And again, that's the reason they call it esports, is that there's elite athletes and then there are their fans. And unlike the fact that you can't really talk to Michael Jordan while he's playing, you can talk to, oh goodness, who's big right now? Pistola. You can watch Pistola stream from his home. You can watch Snipedown stream from his home. You can watch Proteus Joker stream from his college dorm. And it creates a closer experience. Like, I know this person, which again has both upsides and downsides, as most things do. But yeah, so streaming is, I mean, that's a whole nother podcast, actually. And again, it's not covered in the ESA, but I could probably see in the future it being incorporated into it in some way.
It should. I agree with you. It's already big enough, as we just pointed out, that it should be in here, I think.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it's not. Yeah. The biggest stat that surprised me was 63% of parents say video games are a positive part of their child's life. That's it. We won. I don't have to give any of those, I don't have to go on the defensive anymore when I start a presentation. I'll just lead off with that, you know?
Pop the champagne.
Yep.
And bring out the caviar.
I'm retiring.
There you go.
I'm done.
I mean, on one hand, again, the skeptical side of me is, yeah, those are probably parents who have monitors lodged in the backseat of their cars. And when they go on 8-hour road trips, the kids just play video games the whole time. Then yes, that is very valuable experience right there.
Well, it says that it's a positive part of their child's life, not of their life. Okay, with that logic, I think it would be a lot higher.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, oh yeah, like I love it when my kids play video games. They leave me alone. True.
Although there's another stat down there that something I want to say. I can probably find it, but that a large percentage of parents actually play video games with their kids.
59%.
So important. And it's so exciting because there is research out there about how parents playing video games with their children has a really positive impact on kids. Doesn't matter what the game is, but if the parent and the child are engaging in an activity that brings them closer together, both physically and emotionally and socially, and gives them a common experience, there tends to be positive outcomes in terms of behavior and grades and attitude and things like that.
I think the social component is huge and probably has a lot to do with why the parents who were surveyed think that it's positive for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, despite the fact that there's a lot of online bullying, a lot of just horrible, horrible behavior online from people. People who play with their friends, those are really positive experiences. And even extending that to, like you were talking about, live streaming, you know, those are interactions. You know, you're not necessarily just watching somebody. And there's a whole community that forms around it. And those communities, the going to school and talking about it with your friends and, you know, I listen to a lot of gaming podcasts, a lot of them. I think I spend more time listening to gaming podcasts than I do playing games, which is funny. Like, I won't watch the live streams, but I'll listen to people talk about video games. But those communities are important, you know, and I do feel, you know, there's, again, it's part of that culture.
One of the data points they cite is that 56% of frequent gamers, so people who play a lot, play with others. And I know that's one of the biggest things when I'm talking with clinicians is, and I've even gotten this question, one, how are these games social? You know, especially if it's a single player game, how can it possibly be social? And then on top of that, is having a social interaction online, how is that possibly equivalent to an in-person interaction? And so this stat, obviously very helpful. Most people play games socially with, if it's a multiplayer game, for example, and you're playing with people or you can play against people, it's a social interaction. And even if you play a game like Skyrim, which is a single player game, and you can't play with more than one person at once, there's this thing that gamers love to do, and gamers love to talk with people about the games they're playing. And then, pow, you've got a social experience out of a single player game.
Yeah, forums, walkthroughs, even comments on an article or review. Like, there is interaction there, absolutely.
Or even on the playground, like, hey, or playground. You know, for example, my husband and I, we both play Skyrim, and we both really enjoy playing Skyrim, but we play in totally different ways. He's a sneaky thief, and I'm a heavy armor, dual-wielding axe murderer. And we approach the same dungeon in completely different ways, and we get to share our experiences. So even though we're playing a single-player game and we're not interacting with each other in that game, afterwards we talk and we share ideas and we're like, well, how did you get past that puzzle and how did you defeat this and what choice did you make? And it's really exciting, and most people who play video games like to do that.
And again, and I think that's why if parents see something positive coming from the video games, I think that has to be the number one thing, right? That they're able mm-hmm. to make build friendships around them and be able to be social.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I think it's, again, we're talking kind of about future shock, and we've talked about this before, that whatever is new is scary, and there's always the generation before the new thing happens that's like, oh my gosh, this is going to ruin everything, and kids are always on their phone, and they're so antisocial. But kids are more social than they've ever been because they have instant access to all of their friends. And of course, that's not without its negatives, but if a teen is on their phone, I can almost guarantee you, or anybody, I'm not even going to limit to teens, if you're on your phone, you are probably engaging in some kind of social activity.
Okay, I'm looking for the stats for social gaming in particular. It's on page 5. 39% of the most frequent gamers play social games, and the top 3 types of video games that the most frequent gamers play most often, the biggest chunk is social games with 31%. And now, they don't define a social game, right? Did you catch that?
Yeah, they have social game, action game, and like puzzle card game kind of thing, which I don't really know how you play a card game or a game show game without it being at least somewhat social. But yeah, there's no definition of what is social, what is action. And again, that's a limitation. But what did you think when you saw that stat?
Well, I just kept thinking, like, what's a social game? Right? Because even, I don't know, even some games, there are a lot of multiplayer games that I don't like to play because they're so adversarial. Mm-hmm. And I don't consider that social.
Yeah, is it a competitive game? Is it a cooperative game? Like, yeah. What is defining social here? Is it Farmville where you can just share something? Is it, yeah, I would want to know more. And again, there's definitely limitations. There's a lot of methodological stuff and definitional stuff that we don't have, but it is kind of a nice snapshot of what's there. And yeah, again, anytime you would look at one piece of data, you definitely want to corroborate it a little bit. But
yeah, I mean, like I've played a lot of Destiny, a couple hundred hours of Destiny, and for the most part I play by myself. I don't even like doing the multiplayer stuff. And yet, there's always people in that world. Mm-hmm. So it's like an MMO in that sense. So I'm playing and there's other people running around, and I might jump in and help somebody out for a second or completely ignore them, or something might happen and we might fight together, but we're not really interacting. I keep my mic off. I don't want to talk to him. So is that social? Does that count as social just because there's more than one person in that game instance? I don't know. That's why a lot of questions there.
I don't know.
And on that same page is where I thought it was strange that it says the top devices most frequent gamers use to play games. And it said PC at 62%, dedicated game console at 56%, and then smartphone at 35%. Wireless device at 31%? What? What's the difference between a smartphone and a wireless device?
And a dedicated handheld system.
Well, dedicated handheld system, I know what that is. I know what a smartphone is. I don't know what they mean by a wireless device.
Maybe like an iPod? iPad?
No, probably an iPod Touch. Yeah, you're right. iPod Touch or iPad. Yeah, yeah. Because it's not a phone.
That would be a tablet. Yeah, would right. probably be, yeah.
Yep, that makes sense.
I know how my mom plays all of her games is on her tablet.
Yeah, my mom uses her phone. Huh. Are you a big PC gamer?
I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm not part of the PC master race. It's all about the consoles.
Yeah. Do you do any handheld gaming?
Yeah, I have a Nintendo DS, and I love the Phoenix Wright series and the Trauma Center series. Mm-hmm. And I don't play it much, just usually when I'm traveling. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's not as much as I would like to, I guess, because I used to take the Metro all the time, so I had lots of time to play. And now I drive, and it's frowned upon to play my DS while driving.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. How about you?
I do have, I've got a 3DS, I've got a Vita. I do use those a lot, but I'm mostly a console person. Rarely play on my phone or my iPad. And I've never had, even when I've had a really good PC, I can't get it to work right. Mm-hmm. You know, like I've had games crashing on me for 10 years. That's why I refuse to buy... to like invest in a really, really good gaming PC, because supposedly the ones that I've bought are good enough to run the game. Not beautiful, you know? not perfectly, but to just run them. And ah, it just bugs me to think that I have to spend so much money on a decent PC and then have to upgrade the thing. I don't know. Consoles, I don't have to worry about it.
Consoles are easier.
Yes.
I don't want to alienate any of our PC people out there because they tend to be very, very passionate. Yes, PCs can be awesome, but they require upkeep. And I am much too lazy to do that.
The computer I have now, I was playing tons of games. And a friend of mine gifted me one game, booted up on Steam, started playing. Every time I played it, it crashed. Like, I don't understand why that one game, you know, three times it crashed, I never played it again. Because mm-hmm. I don't want to deal with that. And I had the same game on my PS3. And it never crashed. Ugh. Anyway. But I think that has a lot to do with the types of games that people are playing on PC are like time sucks more than maybe a lot of console games.
I mean, when I think about PC games or games that I would play exclusively on the PC because either one, it's a better experience or because that's the only place to get it, you know, World of Warcraft, StarCraft, you know, those kinds of games.
Dota League.
Dota, yeah. these MMORPGs or these MOBAs. You know, there's a lot that goes into them, and RPGs don't particularly appeal to me, so I guess I'm lucky in that way, but I like the idea of playing through a story, and I think console games might be more, I don't know, I'm not even going to say that, I don't like clicking something to death. I would much rather pull a trigger. Let's psychoanalyze that, shall we?
Oh, man. You've said a lot today that
I have. Yeah, I've shared a lot.
I've taken notes.
I used to be a PC gamer. I used to play Command & Conquer. I used to play Wolfenstein 3D. I even played Halo 1 on the PC. But at some point, I had the exact same problem that you talked about earlier, Josue, is that I felt like I was constantly having to keep up with the tech. And when I was younger, you know, I had parents to help me with it. I had friends to help me with it. And it moved at a slower pace. Whereas today, I feel like there's a new graphics card coming out every single day. And devs are pushing the limits of today's PCs and whatnot to an extreme. And then I have a Mac, which really just kind of kills most of the gaming experience on a computer. Just because not a lot of games most games aren't built for it. So... But and they're fun, and they're just two different styles and what you're most comfortable with. Did you ever do PC gaming? I mean, obviously you had stuff crash on you, but was there one that stuck with you that you liked?
No, just a lot of crashes over the years. Wow. Because there's a lot of games I wanted to play, and because you could only play them on PC. Mm-hmm. It just didn't happen. They just announced Star Wars Battlefront, and they said that the PC version is going to have this thing called Dolby Atmos, which is just crazy surround sound. You know, and it's one of those mm-hmm. things where if I had a PC, I'd be upgrading that thing constantly. Like, I wouldn't be able to afford games because I'd want to be able to use every single feature in the game. And
right.
I've gotten to the point where I accept that my console can only do so much and it's good enough and my life is better for it.
Yeah, I think for me, it comes down to time. You know, I can load up a game on my console and it's there and I can just play whenever I want. And it doesn't require the upkeep. If I had more time, maybe I would. Maybe I would get into a dedicated gaming PC. There's a ton of amazing ones out there that I've seen. And, you know, there's games online games on PC only that I want to play. But for better or for worse, I don't have time. So even if I had the tech, I wouldn't have the time. And, of course, if I wanted the time, I'd have to, like, quit making money. So I would have the time, but then not the money to upgrade the tech.
The other day, I was showing my niece. She was trying to build rocket ships, right? Yeah. We had toys and we're building rocket ships out of different things. And I told her, "Oh, I have a game where you can build rocket ships. It's the Kerbal Simulator."
Yeah, yeah.
And I played it before on my PC. I loaded it up for her. Boom, blue screen of death. And she's like, "Why? What happened? Where's the rocket ship game?"
I do remember the rocket ship.
Oh, I was so mad.
Worst rocket ship game ever.
Because, I mean, come on. It's not even like I wasn't playing Crysis 4 or anything like that. You know, I'm just things like that. Well, and speaking of my niece and of the ladies, I think that's one of the most interesting stats, and it's one of the ones that I always like to go to. Let's see. The one I marked in particular was women age 18 or older represent a significantly greater portion of the game-playing population than boys 18 or younger.
And suck it, boys!
So overall, right, it's 33% of gamers are women over age 18, and only 15% are boys under 18.
Yep.
Yeah.
How you like them apples?
So as a lady,
I am. I happen to be one. Yes.
I wasn't asking for confirmation.
I can confirm it. Right here, right now, I will confirm.
Just in case people didn't know. How do you like? What has been your experience? Do you see a lot of girls playing? Do you see a lot of women playing? And have you throughout your life? And do these stats match up with what you've seen?
Well, definitely throughout my life, no. I remember back in like the Halo 1 days, so we're talking 2000, 2001, or even younger, when I was little and growing up at home with my family, I was weird because I was a girl that played video games. And I distinctly remember that. But, you know, hitting in college, I was still pretty much the only girl that played video games. And we eventually got some of our other floor mates to play as well, but nobody really dove into it the way I did. But now I definitely see a lot more women playing, specifically on mobile devices. So like DS, I feel like, is a huge target for women. I know in my gaming program, which is split almost 50-50 male-female, which is amazing.
It's a game design program, correct?
Yes. Okay. It's a game design program. But I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Is a lot of people like to play their mobile games. They like to play games like Dungeons & Dragons or Magic the Gathering. And yeah, I'm definitely seeing more women play. And I think we as a society are seeing women really kind of not start to appear because they've always been there, but becoming more visible. I mean, there are women in the AAA gaming industry who've been there for 10, 20 years. And the thing is, it's becoming an issue now that there's a lack of women in positions. And as more women play, we want to be represented in the games that we're playing. And we're not.
Even though, yeah, and again, the stats say it's about 50-50.
Yeah, the stat in there, overall, yeah. I think it's 44% female, according to the 2015 Essential Facts. So you figure 44% of women are playing video games. Yeah. But when you look at the number of women in games, I think it's 18% was the last number I saw. And of those, only something like, I think it's 6% are actually playable. The rest are window dressings or...
Oh, you mean characters in game, like not in the yeah, not in the industry. In gotcha.
Yeah, okay. No, specifically to characters in games, but I feel like that's a really good allegory for women in the industry as well. I feel like those stats probably reflect that, maybe not perfectly, but the idea that there's this huge population of women who are playing games, and it's not even that there's not representation. It's the idea that adding representation is somehow inherently evil to some people, and how that would be my favorite example, Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, which was the number one game last year. They were super excited when they showed it off because there was a dog and you could have a military dog, and that was like the coolest thing ever. And there were no women soldiers.
Yeah.
Like, wait, the dog is getting more airtime and prep and features, really?
A lot of hullabaloo also about Assassin's Creed. Ugh. And there was that comment about how, like, yeah, it would have been so hard to make women a female character. Animate. Yeah, I mean, it's not worth it. We've got 1,000 people working on this thing. We can't spare a couple more people to animate the female. Yeah, but
I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah, it's everywhere. I mean, Assassin's Creed, Ubisoft is a place I rant. I've had the opportunity to speak with Stone Chin, who is their PR person, and I've shared my feelings with him very candidly. But I mean, for example, the last PAX Prime I was at, they had this amazing Assassin's Creed thing. It was this huge booth, and it had all of these really intricately detailed characters, and all the characters' costumes. There we go. That's the word I'm looking for. So you could see Ezio in the beautiful costume, and all the different Assassin's Creed characters. And then on the very, very end, at about one, maybe two-thirds the size of all the other mannequins with their elaborate costumes, was the one Assassin's Creed female character.
Yeah.
And that made me really mad. Really, really mad.
From the Vita game.
Well, yeah, like, because that's an argument I get all the time, is I'll point out, you know, how incredibly sexist it appears to have all these stories that are all from men's perspectives, especially when you go to France and the most famous assassin of the French Revolution was a woman. It's like you're intentionally going out of your way to not have female characters, or at least have them as playable. And the response is, oh, well, there is a female Assassin's Creed character. Yeah, which was released on the Vita, had 1/10 of the budget that any of the other Assassin's Creed's game has.
She had a button where she could change her dress.
Exactly.
That was a gameplay mechanic.
it's crap like that. It's like, that's not... So, I mean, it is, don't get me wrong, it is getting better.
Yeah, I mean, BioWare is like the completely opposite, you know, side of the spectrum. I think Battlefront, they just announced that there will be female stormtroopers, which is awesome.
Bethesda's really good about it.
Yeah, Bethesda's good. I'm a big IGN fan, and there's a guy on IGN called Damon Hatfield, and he has this joke where he says it's the Damon's rule of gaming. I think it's his Damon's rule of gaming, and it's that if there is a female option, always choose the female option. Right? And it's funny, because for years I've been doing that too, partially as like an experiment. So every single time I have the option, I'll pick a female character. And sometimes, especially like in Destiny and things like that are really social, it's interesting to see how other people react to you. But sometimes in a game, it's also interesting to see how the game reacts to you. Like, again, BioWare is the pinnacle, like the best example of how to deal with any issues of diversity. They actually have a separate voice actor, you know, for the female character, and it's a fully fledged character, and you know, so there's both sides of the spectrum there.
Yeah, it's the idea that because it's better, that means that people need to shut up about it, and I think that's the next hurdle to get over. For example, when people talk about Mass Effect, oh well, you got FemShep, but if you noticed, FemShep was even on the cover, but she was on the reverse side of the cover. And all of the games that shipped had male Shep on the outside. And it's that idea of, okay, here it is. We're not actually going to feature it, but it's there if you want to go find it. And I think that's there's actually a really interesting study done by a 12-year-old girl about 2 weeks ago. She was playing Temple Run and wanted to play as a female character, but she had to pay for it. And so she ran this study where she looked at, I think, the top 20 or 30 games like Temple Run on iTunes, and found that the majority of them either didn't have a female character, or if they had one, you had to pay for her. And so she wrote a letter to all of these developers calling them out, asking why she, as a girl, would have to pay for a girl character where the boys don't have to pay for a boy character, which is awesome, and she's my new hero.
Yeah, that is disgusting. I mean, I can understand BioWare, where they put seemingly enough care onto both sides, and then you make a marketing decision, right? That'll probably be better for you in the long run financially. I can understand that, but charging, that's disgusting.
I mean, I'm not even saying it's something that's intentional. It's not something that people go out of, oh well, we're gonna make them pay for it. It's the idea that default is male, and that is what you see almost even when a game has a female playable character. You're probably going to default as male. And that's a beyond gaming. That's a societal thing, that male is standard, female is optional, which biologically speaking is actually the opposite, but I'm just going to leave that there.
So it's interesting in the stat, right? So it's 44% of game players identify as female. And then, but there isn't, does it talk about the purchasers? Oh, yeah, it does. 41%. 41% of frequent game purchasers are female. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So women are playing and women are buying these games. Yeah. And it's the same thing when people freak out about Frozen. You know, how could Frozen do so well? It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, it does. Because guess what? You know who makes the most purchasing decisions in a house? It's not the dudes. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. It's just not. So the first company that can really get the fact that women are people and that women want to play games and women are willing to buy games and they are willing to do cosplay and go to conventions and do everything they're doing right now and see women as actual valuable customers as opposed to a bonus on top of their male contingent is going to be very, very rich.
Yeah, at least, I mean, if there's 41% of the buying power is on the female side, then at least don't be like antagonistic. Don't
be Dr. Pepper. It's not for women. F you, Dr. Pepper. Seriously, go.
Now I see why you didn't want to touch on that on Lady Tech, my Lady Tech suggestion.
Yeah. I have a lot of feels. A lot of really strong feels about that.
That's why I want to do it. let me see. I think I covered all of the. No, and seriously, it's an important discussion, and I'm glad that it touches on it a little in the stats. It would be interesting if it went into more depth, but again, I mean, I guess that's not necessarily beneficial to them. I mean, and really, what more do you need to know? I mean, those two numbers are pretty self-explanatory, though, right?
And honestly, there are very few people who have that kind of game research methodology focus that you and I do who would even ask the question of, well, I wonder what their sample size was. I wonder what they used as their standard deviation. I wonder what their Cronbach alpha was. There aren't very many people who would be interested in that.
That's way more you than me, by the way. I just want to make sure that's clear.
But I want to know. I want to know. They've talked a couple times about, you know, the most frequent playing gamers. Well, how do you define frequent?
Yeah.
And I'm mostly interested because I'm doing this kinds of research too. And it's really hard to operationalize something like that. What is frequent? And how do you determine who is a frequent player versus a non-frequent player? Is it people over 20 hours versus people under 20 hours? So if you play 19 and a half, is that frequent? Is it not? It's a methodological thing. And I know while that is very important to me, that it makes a lot of people's eyes glaze over. So I'm just going to stop myself right here before I go off on that bandwagon.
Just stop.
And lose listeners.
To support what the ESA is doing here to a certain extent, they do call it the ESA Essential Facts. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that there is a ESA super, super detailed fact somewhere that we can really, really comb through. But this is good. This is good. This is the type of thing where I could take any of those pages because they're already set up like infographics and hand them out at a presentation or put them up on a presentation. And it's really, really easy to understand.
So, yeah, it's a really great snapshot.
Yep. So thank you, ESA. Give us a few more details. Don't be so vague as far as... you know, social and things like that. Just define it. Come on.
Or make
examples.
A super secret psych tech exclusive where we get to comb through all your data. Pretty please.
Yeah, who do we have to call? Let's make some calls.
Ghostbuster.
Let's talk to some people. Before we go, you mentioned that you have a Kickstarter.
Yes. I run a gaming website in the Halo universe, and we are currently kickstarting to get floor space at RTX, which is the Rooster Teeth Convention this August.
And PsychTech will have some representation there too, I believe, right?
At RTX?
Yeah. No?
I mean, I'll be there if that's what you're...
But okay. Like the podcasting thing, right? Is that a thing?
Yeah. I've been asked to be on a panel about podcasting. So no, I thought you were surprising me. We're going, hey, guess what, Kelly? I'm going too.
Well, I mean, the invitation seemed like it was open to both of us. I just can't go. That was my understanding. I hope.
Okay. Please clarify. No, that absolutely. I
didn't
think you could go.
Yeah, no.
You're just full of surprises.
I don't think I can make it. Yeah, and next week we'll be talking about Games for Change, the Games for Change Festival in particular. We'll both be there. Yeah, we're recording on a Monday, and when this comes out, we'll be in the middle of it. But next week, that's what we'll definitely talking about.
And I'm so excited.
Yes. So for more on Games for Change, ESA, video games. Oh, next week will be video games again. This is kind of inevitable.
Once we dove into it, there was no going back.
Yeah. Come on. Let's do some Black Mirror the week after that. Because
okay. So like, not next week. I'm just going to be bursting with...
No, not next week. Thoughts. The week after.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that will be... Ooh, that episode of Black Mirror. Have you seen it yet?
No.
Ooh. Okay. I'm gonna leave the suspense right there and go, I think it's billed as the most disturbing Black Mirror.
That's... Damn, how is that possible?
That's hard to believe,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that'll spark some good conversation.
All right. So for more disturbing talks about tech and psychology... including all of the disturbing things that Kelly said today on the show.
What? It's because I prefer to pull a trigger than click.
That's one of them.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I could see how that would be. I could see that.
Yeah. Visit us at psychtechpodcast.com.
Peace out, Girl Scouts.
And follow us on Twitter. Peace out, PsychTechCast. Yes, at PsychTechCast.
Yes,
okay,
Lindsay,
I always forget.
Doing the peace
right.
sign. And...
So that's all we got for this week. I'm Sway. And thank you, Kelly. And we'll talk next week.
Yep. See you then.